CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC Arts on Air. I'm your host, Ira Nadell. Each week, we feature the ideas and stories of students and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. This evening, Professor Janet Worker, Director of UBC's Infant Studies Center and Canada Research Chair in Psychology. Welcome, Janet. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Ira. It's fantastic to be here.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. I mean, how did you become interested in the study of infants? It strikes me as terribly important, but not immediately a topic that someone or a psychologist would want to pursue.
Right. So I've been interested in the study of infants for a very long time, I think really since I was an undergraduate. And even before I was an undergraduate, I was interested in the biological bases of behavior. And once upon a time, I thought I would be an ethologist, like Conrad Lorenz or Jane Goodall, and, you know, go out into the wilds and study animals in their natural environment. But I kind of started liking humans a lot. And thought that that would be the species that I wanted to understand. And of course, if you're interested in the biological bases, you start very early in life. And if you're interested in what the quintessential qualities are of our species, one of the big ones is language.
Do you have siblings? Were you studying a younger sister or brother or older?
No, I'm the baby in the family. I have an older brother and an older sister, and I didn't babysit much as a child. So it really did start with an interest in animals and other animals, non-human animals, and then moved to humans, quite frankly, when I met and fell in love with my husband.
Right, and language must have been the critical feature, I suppose.
Absolutely.
So then you take it a step further and move into this area of language acquisition. Mm-hmm. Why that as the feature to study as opposed to physical development?
Right. Well, I think it's all a package. But as I mentioned, if you think about the behaviors that animals come endowed with that allow them to navigate and optimize the environments that they're born into, the capability that sets us apart from virtually every other animal is the complex communication system with the formal properties of language. And it turns out that the biological basis for this is built deeply into our evolution, and so it's something to try to understand who we are as humans and how development begins in infancy. Language just seemed like exactly the right place to start.
So this is a question really of inheritance or of instinct or of evolution?
I think it includes evolution, and I'm not sure I'd call it instinct, but it's certainly a preparedness to learn. Babies are interested in human voices the moment they're born. They like to watch talking faces. They prefer speech over other types of signals. And they have a lot of perceptual and conceptual biases that allow them to get started in learning language.
Even from the beginning, say in the first 7 days of life?
Even in the first moments of life. So, yeah.
Shocking. What kind of students will they be? Amazing, amazing. But how do you go about studying them? I mean, you concentrate on infants. How do you study them?
Right. So, we take advantage of a lot of, I guess, physiological responses as well as behavioral responses. Even in utero, we can measure a heart rate deceleration as an indication of interest in one type of sound versus another. With newborn infants, we use non-invasive neuroimaging techniques like near-infrared spectroscopy, where you just shine light on the skull and it gives you a measure of hemoglobin absorption, so blood flow in the brain, so you can see what areas of the brain are responding. But you can also do a behavioral response. Newborn infants have a sucking reflex at birth, and you can condition the sucking reflex in a newborn baby. So they'll change both their rate and their strength or amplitude of sucking in order to be presented with something that they find interesting if you teach them the contingency. So we can measure that, and then it goes on. I can tell you about more techniques as babies get older.
Are you a believer in that if we play Mozart before the baby's born, the baby will have perhaps an inclination towards music?
I'm not sure that they'll have an inclination towards music. There is evidence that babies show preference for their mother's voice at birth. They show preference for their native language at birth. They show preference for songs or stories that were read to them or sung to them prenatally at birth. So there is prenatal learning as well. Whether exposure leads to a child, I mean, ultimately exposure across infancy and childhood has a lot to do with children being interested in music. But whether just a little bit of exposure in utero or even a lot makes that much of a difference or not, I don't know.
Mm. It seems a little bit complicated to determine.
It seems a little bit complicated to
determine. So if we switched it around and the members of your study could speak, what do you think they'd tell you?
That is a great question. Well, I think when they were newborn babies, they wouldn't have much to tell me because I don't think that they can really formulate the thoughts. I think they would say, I want to hear you. I want to see you. I want to be fed. I want to be held. I would like to be held closely while you're talking to me so I can see your face and feel your body movements. And I'd like you to respond when I cry.
Yes, I suppose that's true. Like humans, I mean older humans as well.
Right.
What about gender as a consideration when you're assessing language acquisition? Do you find differences when the infant's male or female?
There are pretty well established gender differences in that girls are, as a group, a little bit more advanced in language acquisition at any age than our boys. The distributions overlap. So a male who's advanced, you know, will be far advanced over a girl who isn't. But there are gender differences from very early in life. So it's not uncommon in infancy research to see girls passing something at 3 months that boys don't pass till 4 months, or at 8 months that boys don't pass till 10 months, etc. There are gender differences across the board in every aspect of language acquisition, but when there are, they almost always favor females.
And what about cultural differences? I mean, do you compare children from North America with children from Europe or from Asia? I mean, what do you learn from that?
Right. So we do a lot of cross-cultural research and cross-linguistic research. So the languages of the world, of course, have different properties. And so if we're interested in how the biases that babies come with interact with the language that they're hearing, we compare babies growing up in different language families. So, for example, a baby growing up in English isn't going to continue to use tone distinctions to distinguish meaning, although they are sensitive to them when they're young, but they'll use them, for example, for stress or new information or something like that as they get older. Whereas a baby growing up in a Chinese language will use a tone distinction, will continue to use a tone distinction to contrast meaning as they learn words. So we look at the properties of language and how babies acquire those, but we also look at the larger cultural context. So what is language used for? How is it directed to babies? How is it informed by other aspects of the culture? And how that influences both acquisition of the first steps in language as well as sort of the categories that babies encode and label in language.
Okay, and then what about age? Do you ever follow this up and say, choose 5 years of age to see where language acquisition might be with a child that you started with infancy, or 3 years of age?
Right. We don't do that much longitudinal research, that's called, if you follow the same child across age. It's not that easy in Vancouver. We're a pretty mobile population, but we do some. And what we find, and others find as well, is that there is some predictive power from the kinds of biases babies have at birth when they start learning about one property or another of their native language, and later pre-reading kind of sensitivities.
Fascinating. And we have not yet discussed bilingual infants. So what are we learning about bilingual children,
right.
Bilingual infants?
So a lot of my research, particularly my SHRC research, is focused on babies growing up bilingual. And I think the big question is, first of all, most of the research on language acquisition, 90% of the published work has been done on babies growing up with English, whereas probably the majority of people in the world grow up, certainly not in an English environment, and the majority grow up in bilingual or multilingual environments. And so when we think that we're learning general principles about how language works and how language is acquired, and we've been studying monolingual children in one funny language, we really probably haven't learned at all how language is acquired. So we've been looking at babies growing up bilingual to see if it's a different set of challenges or a similar sort of process as babies growing up monolingual, and it's a lot of fun. And of course, very relevant in a city like Vancouver, where most of our families, more and more of our families, do involve more than one language in the home.
Does it matter what that second language is?
You know, that's a question I get asked a lot. It seems not to matter so much early in life. It might a little, if you're acquiring two languages simultaneously from birth, which is the population that I study, babies seem to have a lot of different ways to keep their languages distinct while paying attention to the properties and the words and the syntax of each, so they don't tend to confuse them. They do something called code switching as they first start talking, just like any bilingual does. So they might pull a word in from their second language if they don't have one in their first. And they might, they'll code switch more with somebody else who's bilingual than they will with somebody who's monolingual in one of their languages. But it doesn't seem to matter that much if the two languages that they're growing up with are Cantonese and Mandarin, for example, that are very similar, versus Cantonese and English, which are quite dissimilar. They seem to be able to keep each of them apart. Now, as a second language learner, there will be interference from a close language, as well as facilitation. It depends on exactly what you're looking at. But for a baby growing up bilingual, it seems that whatever language or languages they acquire, their little brains are just ready to get going.
Very different than adults when they try to learn a second language a little
later in life.
It's much more of a challenge,
yeah.
I'm sure. Does that carry over to music, do you think, in some way? In other words, very young children beginning to play the piano exhibit talent, or we won't call it talent, but facility, and then perhaps they will also pick up a second instrument and do it, if it's at a younger age, with a little bit more ease than maybe somebody who's 18.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, so first of all, babies who grow up with two languages simultaneously, or three, do a fine job of acquiring both of those, but it doesn't necessarily transfer to a facility in acquiring yet another language that they haven't encountered before when they get older. And so a child who grows up playing the piano won't, you know, it. There's a lot of music theory, of course, that's shared across instruments, and that should be helpful. But I don't think that question exactly has been asked.
Before moving on to, and I'm really quite fascinated by the Infant Studies Center, but before that, have you ever studied twins? Infant twins, and what do you find in those circumstances?
Right. So we haven't made the study of infant twins a focus. Sometimes twins come into the lab, and technically we're not supposed to include both twins in a sample in a particular study because they don't bring independent sources of variance for statistical analyses. But, you know, they're interesting. There are identical twins. There are fraternal twins. Even within identical twins, one may have had more access to nutrients in utero. So they're quite different as babies. They don't necessarily, according to from the literature that I know, they're not necessarily going to go through the steps in language acquisition at the same time. There's work on, of course, the secret languages within twin pairs, between the twins, and that's kind of fun, but it's mostly anecdotal studies.
All right, so now we've entered the Infant Studies Center. What are we going to see? What are we going to listen to? What's going on?
The first thing that you're going to experience when you walk into the Infant Studies Center is that hopefully you're not going to feel like you're in a laboratory, and you're not going to feel like you're on a university campus. Hopefully you're going to feel like you're in a living room, and there's a comfortable sofa, and there are toys to play with, and the kids are immediately attracted to the interesting stuff in their surroundings. And then we'll talk to the parent about whatever particular study they might have signed up for. And they fill out a consent form, of course. And we try to move through that pretty quickly so the baby doesn't get so involved in the toys that they don't want to go into one of our quiet rooms, which is really very much like a recording studio for a radio, because we're doing speech and language processing work. We need to block out sounds from the outside, and we do fairly controlled presentation in my lab. So they might see a video of somebody talking, they might, and we might measure their looking time. They might participate in, as I mentioned, a near-infrared spectroscopy study where we present different types of languages to them, and we measure the forward and backward speech, for example, or native and unfamiliar language, and we measure the neural responses. That would be in a different room. They always sit on their mom's lap. We keep them comfortable and happy.
Do they wear headphones? No.
They don't typically wear headphones because they're in these rooms that are sound attenuated, and that the sound we can control the quality of sound that reaches their ears. As you might imagine, you try to put headphones on a baby, and the first thing they're going to do is rip them off.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
So you also have another new initiative which is underway here at UBC, and it's called the Language Sciences Initiative. What is that about?
Right. It's something I'm really excited about. The Language Sciences Initiative is a new initiative that the three of us, Brian Jick in linguistics, Sid Fells in electrical and computing engineering, and I are taking the lead on, with the wonderful support of a wonderful woman in the community, Marietta Hurst, who's very involved as well. And the idea is that because language is what makes us special, what sets us apart from other animals, the foundation of civilization, the foundation of universities and any kind of study, certainly English, that we feel that, and because there is so much strength at UBC that hasn't been really acknowledged or brought together in the language sciences, that we feel that having an initiative where people who are interested in the study of language in any way, shape, or form, its formal properties, its use in text analysis, its use in medical interviews, in engineering and programming, that if we have, in understanding music, if we have an initiative that allows people to come together who might not otherwise come together, that we could do something new. And at the same time, something that Marietta is very interested in, that we're very excited about as well, is we're putting together, with a lot of interest and enthusiasm from the university, from the provost and vice president, an undergraduate course that will be university-wide, that will be available to anybody from any discipline, whereby they can learn the principles of language and reflect back on their own discipline and think about how putting those two things together can allow them to make their knowledge their own and do something with it that might have an impact on society in some way.
That's terribly important, and indeed I think we probably should have many more courses of that nature where it's a kind of core course in a way, but then you transport yourself and your knowledge back to your individual discipline.
Yeah, we're pretty excited. And the idea, as I said, we could roll it out as early as this September, although it could be a year beyond. Everything's moving very fast. And the idea is eventually to roll it out to the community. And as Marietta Hurst puts it, so that everybody, before they become a parent or a member of a professional, a member of society in any way, they know something about what language is and can use that in an informed way as they move forward.
For over 30 years, there has been one voice in the local Vancouver art scene that has stood above the rest, and that's Discorder, that conspiracy, punk rock, foxcore, sassy, still publishing magazine from CITR. We're one of the established and trusted voices of Vancouver's music and arts culture in the Lower Mainland, with 8,000 copies distributed monthly to over 135 distribution locations, from the Lido to Zulu Records.
Discorder is one of a few magazines published by a community radio station, and we only serve up the freshest local and Canadian goods.
We have interviews with artists, album reviews, live show reviews, and articles about everything important to our crazy, unique, varied, and amazing culture in Vancouver and across the country. Pick up your free copy of Discorder today, or sign up to have it delivered to your door wherever you are.
Check out our website for distribution locations and all the information about advertising and getting involved with Discorder.
Diversify your university involvement and experience a new culture today.
Isaac UBC is the world's largest student-run organization that specializes in helping you get an internship or volunteering opportunity abroad.
With thousands of opportunities in over 127 countries and territories, this is truly an international experience.
Apply today at Isaac.ca. That's AIESEC.ca.
Now, you refer to the community, and I think I should only mention that in May, I believe on May 12th, at Science World at 5:30, you'll be giving a presentation. What will that be about?
Right. So the title of that presentation is The Bilingual Baby, and it will be about basically what it means to grow up with two languages from birth, and how a bilingual baby negotiates that and becomes a member of a speaker of two languages and a member of two cultures, and how that works together. And I think it'll be pretty exciting for families wherein there's sometimes discouragement for using the native language or the heritage language, and that discouragement is really unfounded because babies do just a great job at mastering two languages, and they have all sorts of advantages cognitively that are, so does a monolingual baby, but a different set of them, and they can stay connected to grandma and grandpa and their past, and it's
Sounds absolutely fabulous. So it's open to the public?
It's open to the public.
Again, May 12th, 5:30 p.m. at Science World. Special thanks to you, Janet, for coming in this evening. It's been absolutely fabulous. I've been speaking with Professor Janet Worker, Director of UBC's Infant Studies Center and a Professor of Psychology in the Faculty of Arts at UBC. And stay tuned for future conversations with the always fascinating students and members of UBC's Faculty of Arts. Thank you again, Janet.
Thank you so much, Ira.
And stay tuned for Peanut Butter and Jams, a fabulous show focusing on local food and music, which you can hear next on CITR 101.9.